Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
This is James Altucher at the James Altucher Show, and I'm here with my co-host, Aaron Brabham. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, James. Thanks for having me back.
Aaron, we just saw each other the other day in warm Miami. Now I'm in cold New York. I hope you're still enjoying the warmth in Florida.
Yeah, I definitely am. I'm in Winter Park, Florida. It's kind of ironic. I'm living in Winter Park, but it's actually in Orlando, and it's very, very warm. So, James, we were both down there for the inaugural Stansberry Society event, which I thought was wonderful. I'd like to get your quick take on it, and then we'll kind of roll into some of the challenges you had right before you had to give your presentation. But what were your thoughts on it?
Well, I'll tell you, going down there, I was worried everyone was going to be really, like, you know, super conservative. The end of the world is coming. Scare, scare, fear, fear. And I was wondering, what am I going to say to an audience like that? But everybody wants the same thing, which is, okay, we know a little bit about what's going on in the world, but the world is very hard to predict. So what I really want to know is, how can I just survive, be happy, feed my family, and, you know, keep on fighting the good fight every day? And I found that's what people were hungry for. So I get there, and the first thing that happened was I got totally scared to death, because I saw on the schedule there was a mystery guest coming right before me. And then I found out the night before that the mystery guest was Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks guy. You know, there was the whole movie about WikiLeaks and about Julian, and he's a very smart guy. And, you know, the first thing I thought was, what, is he going to actually be here? Isn't he under, like, arrest somewhere? So it turns out he was being Skyped in from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's not necessarily under house arrest, but he can't leave there. So I don't know what kind of life that is. But anyway, here he was Skyping into the conference. And I was scared to death because I was speaking immediately after him. Like, there would be no break at all. Like, his Skype would go down while I would be walking on the stage. And I figured the only thing people in the audience would be thinking was, oh my God, I just saw Julian Assange. I can't wait to tell my wife, husband, boyfriend, kids, whatever about it. And they would not be thinking about me at all. And it would ruin my entire talk, no matter what I said. So I was literally up all night. This was almost like solving a puzzle. Like, you know, public speaking is very difficult. In fact, I'm even writing a book about public speaking. But despite that, every time you speak publicly, it's in front of a new audience with new challenges, and it's a puzzle that has to be solved. So I had to figure out, what the hell am I going to do to cut the cord between the audience and what they just saw? Not to make them forget what they just saw, because the information was valuable, whatever it is he was going to say, but I had to cut that cord so that they would listen to me. And I was scared to death. I was, you know, and this is related to the topic of this podcast today, I was really anxious. I was feeling a lot of anxiety about it.
On that topic, so James, your guest today is Charlie Hone, and he'll come up in a minute, and it's a great interview that you guys conducted, and a lot of it is anxiety. So really quickly, I know our audience is in suspense, the listeners are. Tell them how you kind of broke their thinking and had them focus on you, because I thought you gave the best speech. I know a lot of other people, including a lot of directors in our company, thought that you wowed the audience. You won them over. You were the perfect transition, because we had Porter introduce himself first. He was also the moderator. So you have the owner of the company. Then you go into Julian Assange, who's this world-renowned, you know, guy that's in hiding in Ecuadorian embassy in London. And then you have Mr. Upbeat James Altucher coming on stage. How did you do it? Tell our listeners.
Well, okay, so there's sort of a before, during, and after. The before is essentially the night before, how am I going to switch my preparation? And the way I view public speaking now, and this is not always how I viewed it, is that my entire life has been preparation. I don't need to prepare, and this is not true for everyone, but for me, I don't like to prepare slides or a PowerPoint. I figure my entire life, every single moment, has been preparation. And when I'm on the stage, I'm there that moment using all my lifetime preparation. But very specifically, like I said before, I had to solve a problem first. And the problem was cutting the cord, cutting that kind of visceral excitement between the audience and Julian so that they would listen to me. Actually, first thing I did was I watched the movie WikiLeaks, or, you know, the movie that was about Julian Assange. And I kind of figured several things. One is he was going to be very smart, but he was going to speak in a monotone. He was going to speak in an accent, and he was going to have all the problems that are associated with Skype, whereas I was going to be there live. So I can use all of those things to my advantage. And when you say advantage, it's not like I was competing against him, but a little bit I felt like I was. I'm a competitive speaker, and I wanted I wanted people to like me, and I wanted to be entertaining to the audience. So I figured I had some advantages. So what I did then was I watched an enormous amount of stand-up comedy, and I watched Louis C.K., Daniel Tosh, Anthony Jeselnik. I watched music videos from The Lonely Island. I probably watched Jimmy Fallon had his first week on The Tonight Show, so I watched Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake doing their video History of Rap. So I saw how these people went all out in their experience to entertain. So, you know, the great thing about stand-up comedians is every movement they do is part of the act. It's not just the jokes. They're not just telling jokes. They're doing it with their inflections. They're doing it with their movements. They're doing it with different accents and impressions. And they go all out. They cannot hold back in their entertainment of the audience, even while they're trying to educate. So it's edutainment. So I did that as kind of initial preparation. And then I had to figure out, well, how am I going to tie what Julian said into what I'm going to say? So I took my phone, and as I was walking on the stage, I'm talking to Claudia, my wife, and I'm basically addressing what the audience is thinking. So I'm saying to Claudia, yeah, it really was Julian Assange. No, he wasn't there. But look, listen, I'm on the stage right now. I have to go. So, and then I hold up the phone to the audience, and I say, I'm sick of this thing. Not only is Big Brother listening to me like the government, but guys like Julian Assange are listening to the government, you know, listening to me, talking to my wife. So I want a kinder and gentler Big Brother. So I took the phone and I said, I have one solution. I'm never going to use a phone again. I'm sick of these things. And so I took my Samsung Galaxy Note 2 and turned around and I smashed it as hard as I could against the floor. It smashed into a million pieces. And I had already prearranged with the stage guy that while I was going on to my next idea that I was going to talk about, he would come through with like this stage size broom and sweep away all the pieces. Because that I wanted that to symbolize, okay, that's the end of the last talk. That's the end of the Julian talk. And now my talk begins. So I walk up to the podium and I got into my next part of the talk, which would then shock the audience a little bit more, but in a different way. So I said, listen, I got some somewhat surprising family news last night, and it forced me to change my entire talk, which was actually true, Aaron. I got this call from my cousin, and my cousin was on this podcast a few weeks ago, AJ Jacobs. And I got this call, and he explained to me how my aunt's fifth grade aunt's father's wife's seventh great grandnephew was Barack Obama. And so that, of course, again, further cuts the cord, but doesn't make it about Julian. It makes it about me. And again, I'm continuing this transition from Julian's talk into my talk. And then I made some jokes based on that. And then I was able to fully get into my talk. And, you know, along the way, while people were laughing, I was able to establish my credentials, like why I'm here talking. But at the same time, I wanted everybody laughing. People don't remember exactly what you say, but they remember how you make them feel. So And also the laughter itself coming from the audience helped me to reduce my anxiety. It gave me energy. It helped, you know, when you make people laugh, it and when you entertain people and when you educate people, it gives you energy. So it's not just food that gives you energy. It's kind of the energy of others give you energy as well. And that's how, for me, I reduced anxiety. And it was very powerful technique. It worked very well. I got a lot of great feedback, like you just said. I got a lot of great feedback on the talk. And it shows that you can't blindly do the same talk over and over. You have to view talks and experiences and business meetings as puzzles that you have to solve, problems that you have to work through. And every problem has a unique solution. And if you view situations in life that way, and if you come up with a unique solution for every unique situation, you'll end up being very successful, because those tiny successes compound into huge success. And it worked for this talk, and it worked. I try to make it work for everything I do.
Nice breakdown, James. We'll give a brief introduction to Charlie Hone, and then we'll let our listeners jump into the interview.
Sure. Charlie is a great, incredibly successful guy. He helped, you know, we all know Tim Ferriss wrote The 4-Hour Workweek, The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Chef. Charlie helped him launch these books. He helped him market the books. He really planned, you know, Tim is a fantastic marketer. He doesn't view a book as just writing a book and then handing it off to the publisher. He views a book launch as an entire event, an experience. And Charlie Hone was the guy organizing these experiences. And he threw his all into it. And during that process, you know, like we often encounter in life, he got burnt out. He got so burnt out and anxious, it basically caused him to quit his job and practically go into recovery mode. Like, how was he going to recover from this anxiety? Was he feeling so much anxiety he couldn't get out of bed? And the solution he came up with, which he wrote about in his book that he describes in the podcast, the solution he came up with was, I thought, incredibly unique and a solution I'm going to try in my life. And I'll let Charlie speak for himself, but again, I encourage people to try this technique in their lives and just see how it works. And if it works well, you know, write in at james@stansberryradio.com and tell me how it works in your life. And I'd really like to hear. So with that, on to Charlie Hone. I am here with my good friend, Charlie Hone, and Charlie, you are an expert on so many things. There's so many topics we can talk about, but how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, and I'm just thrilled to be on. Thanks for having me as a guest, James.
So Charlie, I'm going to describe your background a little bit. You recently self-published a book, Play It Away, A Workaholic's Cure for Anxiety. You've also been you're a marketing expert. You did marketing for best-selling authors like Tim Ferriss, Ramit Sethi, and others, and I'm going to talk about that a bit as well. And but what I really want to talk about first is your cure for anxiety and the topic of your book. So what was your experience initially? Like, why were you anxious? You were such a successful young guy, and it sounded like you were making money. Like, I read through your bio. You worked with all these, like, famous people doing all this fun stuff, and we'll talk about those things later. But what was making you anxious? Or maybe nothing was making you anxious, but you were anxious anyway.
Right. The main thing that really kind of that I was missing for so long, that was ultimately driving me to do all these unhealthy things that was making me anxious, was I was taking my work so seriously. I originally got into those positions because during the recession, that was in 2008, that was when I graduated from college, and no one was hiring, and I was applying to all these companies that were ignoring me, that I didn't even want to work for. So I decided I'm going to do stuff that I just actually want to do that's fun. And I found myself working with cool people like Ramit and Tim. And but somewhere along the way, the money became a huge issue, and me wanting to be the best and to dominate and being so focused on the future and
Can you describe a little bit of what that means? Like, A, you said money became an issue, and you thinking about the future. Like, you were very young. What were you thinking about the future, and how was money getting in the way of this?
Sure. So I'm from Colorado, and I moved out to Silicon Valley, basically, and I was surrounded by all these really successful, wealthy entrepreneurs, and I wanted to be like them. And so when I got burned out and actually had to quit and take some time off, I was so worried because I felt like I'd blown it and I was losing money. And so I was obsessed with, okay, I have to become a millionaire. I have to become a successful CEO now. And
how
so
old were you then?
I was 25 at the time. I'm 27 now.
You know, I find with people who are in their 20s that they need to have it all planned out. And I find this to be more true now even than it was, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. They need to kind of have it figured out in advance or they start to feel like a failure. Do you find that among your peers?
Yeah, totally. But why do you think that is? You know,
Because the world has become more uncertain. You know, even the status of our trust in the U.S. dollar or our trust in the U.S. banks or our trust in the U.S. government, regardless of political affiliation, it almost doesn't matter. It's very confused. We live in a very confusing world that has, you know, we're in the middle of all these wars. And that has never stopped. It's been going on for 10 years. And I think now the generation that's been graduating over the past 5, 6, 10 years, I think that uncertainty has really gotten to them.
Yeah, totally. And the fact that we're kind of pressured all throughout our young adult lives to kind of get things figured out and pigeonhole ourselves into some sort of career that we're not told is unlikely to work out over the long run. You know, you go through these mini stretches of trying things that you don't really like.
You make a really good point. Like, I can tell you from my own experience, I've probably switched careers, not just jobs, but careers 7 or 8 times since I was your age. Forget about from 22 to 27, but since I was 27, I've switched careers. And sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a very bad way. And every single time, though, it was anxiety inducing and coming up with methods of dealing with that anxiety, you know, up until the current day is, you know, and I'm 46 years old right now, dealing with anxiety on a daily basis is a daily practice. Like, it's not something that disappears. It's an illness that we're stuck with almost as a society.
Right. And you have the 4 cornerstones that you use and incorporate in your daily practice. And that works for you, the mental, spiritual, physical, and
physical and emotional. Yeah. So I kind of feel that always if you could check the box on physical health, emotional health, which just means be around people who you love and respect, mental health, which means keeping your idea muscle exercised, and what I call spiritual health. Spiritual is almost a bad word, but it's really more just feeling grateful for what you have in your life. For me, I make sure every day I check the box on those, and my life changes every 6 months in incredible ways because of that. But you know, having read your story and how your method of curing anxiety, I see it as very similar, actually, and I really love some of your examples. So maybe talk about when you hit bottom with this and what your actual cure for anxiety was and what you tried along the way before you found that cure.
Totally. So when I hit bottom, boy, it was after I'd quit 2 really great jobs or prestigious jobs that everyone congratulated me on. I quit them basically within a matter of months. So the first was I quit working with Tim Ferriss, who I'd worked with for 3 years as his director of special projects, his full-time assistant. And the reason I quit was I was really burned out. I couldn't detach myself from work. because I wanted to be indispensable, and so I was working around the clock and drinking caffeine all day, and we were working on the 4-hour chef at the time, and the
excellent book, by the way, I highly recommend it.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally amazing. It's a monster. And he offered to double my salary to help him get through it. So I was stoked to do that, and I felt really grateful to be in that position, but I was also exhausted. And a few things happened all at once. The deadline got pushed back 3 months, and then a family member of mine died, and then a close friend attempted suicide. And that all happened within 48 hours, and that kind of just pushed me over the emotional brink, and I just told him I had to quit. And so I took a few months off, and I felt really anxious because I was going through the motions of work without actually doing anything. So I was staying up real late, checking email, and trying to feel productive.
Well, why do you think you were going through the motions? Was it almost like you were addicted to the adrenaline?
It was a part of that. I think it was mostly because of the guilt that I felt for not working. I felt really guilty because everybody had said, you know, this is such, congratulations, like you're doing it, you're living the dream sort of thing. And I felt like I'd burned a bridge, and I was really scared, which was not true, but I was really scared that Tim hated me for kind of leaving him in the middle of this enormous project. And I felt really insecure about it. And I was really anxious after I quit, and I just kept it all inside, and I kept on the surface, you know, that everything was fine, and I was going to get the future all figured out, and, you know, because everyone asked me, what are you going to do next? And I had no idea, and I was really pretty scared. But I ended up working with a couple friends of mine at an app startup, and we did well, you know, within a few months. We'd made a couple million in revenue, but I just realized that at the end of those few months that I just didn't care about apps, and I'd only done it because I looked at it as, hey, this is the most exciting industry in the history of capitalism. Like, Facebook had just bought Instagram for $1 billion, and Zynga had bought Draw Something for $250 million. So I was really drawn to that prestige element of, hey, I'm going to be a founder of this profitable company. And I realized I was ultimately in it for the wrong reason, and I quit. And that's when I got to my really lowest point and started having panic attacks. And it was the worst. That period of my life, which lasted about a year, was the worst I think I've felt ever. It just felt like I was dead inside. And I remember having a talk with my girlfriend at the time and telling her that, and being envious because she could cry. You know, when I told her that, she started crying, and I was just like, I can't even feel, you know, my emotions aren't in check. I just feel awful all the time. I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack.
And, you know, I just want to address this because, you know, you are young, and some of our audience, including myself, is, you know, we're decades older. But this is not going to be the only time, you know, you'll hit bottom, obviously.
Right.
And the good news is that at some point in one's life, hopefully, you come up with methods of dealing with that feelings of, you know, either anxiety or bottom, or feeling stuck, or feeling like you can't get your emotions out. And it sounds like you came up with, and you wrote a book about it, a very clever way of dealing with this anxiety.
Right. Yeah. So the realization I had, you know, my anxiety at that time was debilitating. Like, it was ruining my relationships. It was preventing me from working. But what I realized one night, just by happenstance, I was over at our friend Tucker Max's apartment, and I was looking at his bookshelf, and I came across a book called Play by a guy named Stuart Brown. And I sat down and read it, and it was this tidal wave of a realization that I was preventing myself, unconsciously preventing myself from having guilt-free fun, and I preventing myself from playing and having fun with people and approaching life as a series of opportunities to have fun. And it was just that simple shift in how I viewed the world that changed everything. It changed it from being a prison to becoming a playground.
Well, I like you told one story about how you wanted to meet your friend, or somebody contacted you, David. He wanted to meet you, and you said, sure, let's go play catch, which I thought is great, because usually people say, oh, yeah, let's meet at Starbucks and have a coffee.
Right.
And the idea of, like, saying, hey, let's play catch, it brings back these feelings and emotions from when really life was just carefree and fun.
Exactly. Exactly. And it took – it was so nice because it took the seriousness out of that meeting. And I hate those meetings normally. Because both sides have a facade up of, like, hey, I really appreciate what you're doing. I'm trying to impress you and get something out of you. And it's just this weird dynamic that we all kind of agree to. And I get sick of it. And so we did this game of catch, and it was just really nice. Like, it loosened the tension, and we didn't have to talk the whole time or drink stimulants to enjoy each other's company.
That's great. So what are other examples of play? Like, what are some other kind of play meetings that you've had during the course of reducing your anxiety levels?
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine one night was super anxious because she'd missed a deadline and she was planning on staying up all night. And we kidnapped her to go play mini golf. And that was really fun. And
wait, was she screaming though? Like, I gotta finish this. I have a deadline.
Yeah, she was freaking out, and she was really freaking out. And we just noticed we took a look at her work. She was designing a website, and she had so many hours ahead of her, and it just wasn't coming together. And this is when I started noticing that playing was actually it helps you be more productive because it turns your brain off and allows you to relax. And then when you return to the work, you actually can do it better and faster. And she was able to go back to the site and finish it in a couple hours.
Well, and I wouldn't say it turns off your brain. I would say it activates other parts of your brain so that when you're finally back at your desk and working, your brain is on fire, like the neurons are firing all over the place.
Yeah. I guess I was referring to a specific type of play, the kind where you're running around, something like Ultimate Frisbee or something, because then it's kind of impossible for your brain to be having these deep thoughts. So that kind of play to me is very similar to sleep in that your mind gets to relax and not take in tons of information that it has to process. You can just be.
It's interesting because I used to day trade for a living, and then I ran a hedge fund. And often, you know, that's an incredibly stressful business, particularly the day trading. That's the topic of another podcast probably, but that's extraordinarily stressful. And what I would often do is play chess to kind of, during the market, while the market was open, to kind of relieve the stress a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And now you're a chess master.
Yeah. So which was interesting. So I've played chess for many years. I've played in many chess tournaments. I'm a high ranking player, but, so sometimes it was stressful if I didn't maintain, let's say, my ranking on whatever site I was on. But usually it was a good way to at least turn my brain in another direction. Another thing I do often is I'll go into the city and play backgammon with friends in a restaurant, and that will keep me, you know, completely off what is happening in the market or in other parts of my life. I found that to be very anxiety reducing for myself.
Right.
Not as physical, though. So I should try more of, like, the playing catch or running around type of activity.
Yeah. Do you do yoga?
Yeah, I do yoga, and I've my wife's a yoga instructor, and we've actually been to India several times doing yoga, and I find that to be extremely stress-reducing, because when you're twisting your body in these awkward shapes, you're definitely not thinking about what you have to do next on the job. Like, that's it's impossible. Do you do yoga?
I've done it. I mean, you know that since your wife's a yoga instructor, but yoga means with God, right?
You know, there's a lot of different meanings, but that could be like that could be one of them, sort of joined with a higher entity, or, you know, it could also mean separate. So separate from the world we live in.
Right. Yeah. So I did Kriya yoga for a long time, which is just basically a certain style of meditation that you're focusing on different areas in the spine. But I've also done the traditional types of yoga. The physical types of play, that the outdoor sports where you're running around and really getting your heart rate up and having to breathe a lot, I've found to be the most anxiety reducing, because you're not only getting fun exercise, you're also being around people and bonding with them over something where there's really not that much pressure. And I thought back when this was another realization when I read that book Play, was my best friends throughout my life have been people I played sports with, and I'm still friends with them, and I miss having that connection. And it's unfortunate when you get older how serious sports become and how serious play becomes.
That's a really good point. Like, when you're a kid, you and a friend could just take a rock, put it in the street, and try to kick it past each other, and that's a whole game. And you're going to get dirty and muddy and push each other and laugh, and eventually the rock is going to end up on one side or the other, and that's a whole game.
Oh, yeah. We used to play this every single day after middle school, I think from grade 4 to 6. We had this this ditch on the way to school, or between school and our houses, that we would walk to, and one team would stand on one side of the ditch, the other team would stand on the other, and we would just throw rocks at each other and see if we could hit each other.
You imagine, like, walking down, like, Park Avenue in New York City, where everybody, 100% of the people, men and women, are in suits, and seeing anybody, like, throw rocks at each other?
I know. You can't even imagine it. There's something in San Francisco that I loved. It's on Valentine's Day, actually. It's this massive pillow fight that they do down at the Embarcadero. And literally, like, 1,000 people show up and just have pillows and just fight each other. It's really fun.
Oh, yeah, that happened on Wall Street. That happens once a year as well, actually. I used to live on Wall Street, and I remembered when it was happening, where there was just, like, shredded pillows all over the street one Saturday or Sunday. But, you know, it's interesting, though, because, like, you look at a guy like Steve Jobs, he would even do this technique, where not exactly running around, obviously, because he was sick for many years, but, you know, some of his most important meetings were during walks outside of the office. Like, sometimes you have to get out of your standard routine in order to actually make a real connection with somebody.
Yeah, I love walking meetings, by the way. It's so nice, and it's so much more stimulating. Why wouldn't you do that?
Right, and yet many people don't. Like, I advise many of the listeners to really pay attention to this. And, you know, what I often do is I'll take out a notebook and I'll write down my routine line by line and just see if it's become too standardized. Like, am I too set in a routine? And I try to figure out at least one thing I can scratch out and one thing I can put in that is fun, whether it's, you know, playing ping pong or swimming or going kayaking in the middle of the day. I live right by a river. So often there's things you can do. It's not going to take away from your work. It's going to make life better, which is ultimately the key at the end of all of this. And it'll actually probably improve your work as well.
Totally. And you brought up a great point, actually, because for me, it's so easy to get caught in the trap of just working all the time. And I found that when I actually scheduled a time in the day to play, to do something guilt-free and for fun, I actually committed to doing it. And just having it in my schedule, even though it goes against the spontaneous nature of play, just actually cutting out a chunk of time every day and saying, this is my time to just have fun. Because otherwise, it's just not going to happen. You have to make it a priority.
Yeah, I mean, there's two points there. You're right. It's not going to happen if you don't make it a priority. The other point that's very important and a little more subtle is that working 20 hours a day or working even like 12 hours a day or 8 hours a day is often not very productive. Like there comes a point where there's only marginal utility to working more. And so I've interviewed and looked at a lot of different masters of their industry and asked them, how many hours a day do you work? And the common answer, actually, believe it or not, is about 3 or 4 hours a day. And after that, they don't. It's much better for these people who are masters in their industry. I'm talking like, let's say, the world chess champion, you know, or the world champion at tennis, or, you know, some business leader. Working more than 4 or 5 hours a day sort of shows that you're not really being efficient with your time.
Right. And that's the main thing, is that those people who work 3 or 4 hours a day, during those hours, they're focused. They don't get distracted. And I think the majority of us, because we're on computers for a lot of our work, it's really easy for us to get sidetracked and to constantly just escape work because it's half a second away. But I found, I don't know what you do, James, but what I've found that works best for me when I really need to get work done is to set an alarm or set a timer for 1 hour and just do the one thing I need to do and nothing else. And then when the timer goes off, I can take a break and everything. But just making that the focus for a certain period of time is what really helps for me.
Yeah, I usually don't do it by time, but by activity. And I guess I roughly know how much time an activity will take. So, for instance, writing an article or preparing for this podcast, I took about an hour. But at that time, I read, you know, many of the things that you've written. I understood where you were coming from. And, you know, then I move on. Then I take my break. So my break today involved, you know, going to this new juicing establishment and drinking healthy, talking to my wife, hanging out a little bit, and then coming back and doing this podcast. And then later on, I'm sure I'll play chess because I do that every single day.
Nice.
But, so what did you do after you discovered this? Like, how did you get back into the swing of things? What are you working on now? Like, I know you wrote a book, so Play It Away, A Workaholic's Cure for Anxiety, by Charlie Hoehn, H-O-E-H-N. I encourage people to find it on Amazon and to buy the book to really see everything that you're talking about here. But what are you working on now?
Thanks. I mean, right now it's kind of in book marketing mode because I've been down this path with Tim and all those other guys. I know that I want to get the book in as many people's hands as I can. So really my only focus over the last month or so and probably the next month is just going to be on getting this book up and running. I'm also thinking about, I haven't quite decided. I'm thinking about doing a support group for like less than 100 people who really need to be held accountable, who want to be held accountable and get through the first month of recommendations in the book, because it's divided up as like a 4-week plan. So just doing a support group for them. And that's pretty much it. Apart from that, you know, during the week, I do improv once a week. I've been doing that for the last 6 months. I do that for 3 hours every week. And just try and make an effort to go have some fun with friends, go to the driving range or something, and to do exercise that is fun for me, that I enjoy, and to do stuff that's fun.
I want to ask you about marketing your book, because, you know, I think it was Seth Godin who said over the past year, probably 15 million ISBNs were registered. And my guess is most of that is self-published books. And yeah, this is an industry, like, I know the guys at Amazon very well. This is an industry that has, it's like the Gutenberg press all over again. It's an innovation. No longer are there gatekeepers to publishing a book. And many best-selling books now have been self-published. We're going to have, in a few weeks, we're going to have Hugh Howey on the show, and he wrote the science fiction bestseller, Wool. E.L. James self-published initially, 50 Shades of Grey. So a lot of these books that then become bestsellers started off as self-published. What do you, and again, you're coming at it from the point of view, you are a professional book marketer, so you did this for Tim Ferriss, for Ramit Sethi, for Tucker. What would you say are kind of like the top five guidelines to think of in book marketing? Forgetting, of course, it's got to be a good book to begin with. What do you do after that?
I think it's important to validate whether people are willing to pay money, and there are a number of ways you can do this, but I think it actually is important to validate that people are willing to pay money for the book that you're making. You know, you obviously, like you said, you want to write a book that's good, but I don't think that's enough necessarily. So the way that I validated this book was I wrote a blog post called How I Cured My Anxiety. And I just wanted to see what people's reaction was. And I wasn't planning on making this into a book at the time. And that post blew up. It did really well. And I think for the last year, it's been in the top two results for cure anxiety. And I put a sign-up form at the end of that post and said, would you be interested in a book about this topic? And 100 people signed up in the first couple of days. And so I thought maybe I have something there. Another way that aspiring authors could validate, or self-published writers could validate whether their book is going to work, is study the top charts on Amazon for a couple of weeks and just see what people are actually buying. You know, take notice of the trending, you know, imagery and the title descriptions and the stuff that keeps coming up in your respective category that people actually demand, because you can actually write the book that you want, but if it's not framed in a way that your target readers are familiar with and are already buying, then it's going to be a much harder sell. So I think that's the very first step, is figuring out what people actually want and are willing to pay for, because the rest going forward is much easier.
Well, it's amazing after 50 Shades of Grey sort of opened the door on kind of, let's call it respectable female pornography, that there were so many copycats that actually became major bestsellers, like in the top 10 on Amazon, which sells, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies.
Right, exactly. And it's really hard to be the leader of the pack, the 50 Shades of Grey that opens the door for everyone else. I think it's much easier to draft behind them than it is to try and innovate, because, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey might have never taken off, you know, if it came at the wrong time.
Well, what about this as a business idea? So you take every bestseller in the top 100 every week, and you write kind of the Cliff's Notes to that bestseller. So like a 3-page book, which you then, like the Cliff's Notes, you know, or the Notes to 50 Shades of Grey, Charlie's Notes to, I don't know, Cain and Abel, whatever the latest bestsellers, or, you know, Charlie's Notes to The Something by John Grisham. You know, what about an idea. Which kind of plays off of all these bestsellers and piggybacks on their search?
I think that's a great idea. And, you know, somebody who kind of does a version of that is Brain Picking. She just gives her summaries of the books that she likes, and she writes about interesting books. And
yeah, so that's brainpickings.org, Maria Popova. I think she's a genius. Her tastes are very highbrow. Like, so she's not going to do this on necessarily 50 Shades of Grey, but she'll do it on you know, Henry Miller, you know, Tropic of Cancer, or Charles Bukowski, or whatever. But again, what about just because Amazon is this great platform you can upload to any, you can upload anything you write and sell it the next day. Just take every single book and outsource to India, have someone write a 3-page summary, then you make a cover and throw it up there. Then anyone searching, you know, the next 50 Shades of Grey is going to come up with your little book as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart idea. And that's a really easy way to, and you can do the same cover for each of them. You can charge $1 or $2 for this quick summary, and then they can all cross promote each other. And all of a sudden, you have a business on your hands.
Yeah, because like you can use a site like Fiverr to actually write like a 3-page summary have someone write 3-page summaries for 100 books for, you know, $10 a book, and you're gonna, you know, definitely sell, you know, make more than, you know, $10 a book its lifespan. So it'll pay for itself. I'm just riffing here, but it sounds like a fun little business.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I like it a lot, especially if you're an avid reader. That just makes sense to do.
Yeah, or if you want to, you know, your audience is the people who keep hearing about these books, but like, I don't want to read 50 Shades of Grey, for instance, but I wouldn't mind knowing what it's about so I can talk about it, like, with at a party or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
I was just riffing off of your idea of, you know, kind of tracking what plays and what doesn't. You know, I use a similar technique in that before I even post a blog, I post an article on a Facebook status update, and then I could directly see how much engagement it gets among my circle of friends. And then if it gets a certain level of engagement, I'll do it on Quora.com, and I'll see how many people upvote it, downvote it, have comments on it. Then when I feel the engagement's good enough and I'm rewriting the whole time, I post it on my blog. Then if the engagement there is good, I'll include it as a chapter in my book. I'll rewrite again, I'll include it as a chapter in a book.
Yeah, I loved your stuff, and I've read a bunch of your stuff on Quora, actually, too. I read your blog, of course, but I remember coming across, like, all these people who didn't succeed. Somebody asked what they should do if they feel like they're lost in their 20s, and you said all these people succeeded way late in their life, you know, from Rodney Dangerfield to the guy who invented Top Ramen noodles, and you related to how that, you know, affected your life, and I thought it was great.
Yeah, that became, or a version of that became a chapter in my latest book, Choose Yourself, because it was such a popular post. You know, I expanded it and added more, and it became a chapter in my last book. So so it's interesting, and that's also a way I'm testing material for my next book. So that, I agree with you. It is very important. You know, it's too easy to smoke your own crack, and so it's very important to make sure other people want to smoke it as well. And your way of validating is very powerful. So that's good.
I wanted to share one more thing because it's similar to what we're talking about. Something I did for my book, and our friend Sean Platt has done for his books, is we have beta readers. So I had I did a post where I said, hey, I'm working on this book. It's about this topic, and I'm looking for people who have gone through similar stuff and who have backgrounds in maybe writing or journalism, or, you know, legit people who could help with the editing of my book. And I said, if you're interested, just apply here. And I had about 100 people apply. I picked, I think, around 30 of them. And I gave them an early version of my book, Play It Away. And they edited it for free. They gave their thoughts, and I said, just be ruthless. Like, destroy me if there's something stupid in there or something you disagree with. And they made the book. I'm not joking. Like, if I'd gone the traditional route with a traditional publisher, I would have had one editor. And it's just one person who's a professional who's juggling all these other books, who doesn't really care about my book, giving me their thoughts. And all they're trying to do really is cover their tracks and prevent me from getting in legal trouble and make them look professional. whereas these were my actual target readers giving me their feedback on the book and adding in their thoughts. And not only did they make the book 10 times better than if I'd gone through a professional editor, they actually, I've baked them into the book. And so now they want to see the book succeed. The day I came out with the book, I just asked them, hey, will you guys put up an Amazon review? Here's a free digital copy of the book. Thank you so much. And I put them all in the acknowledgments. And so I think that's such an easy way to not only get readers invested in your book early on and get a bunch of people invested in your success, but also to make your book great for the people who want to read that, because that move surely prevented a lot of 1- and 2-star reviews on Amazon.
Well, also, it sounds like an excellent marketing technique, because they have a vested interest now. They have commitment bias. They've made a commitment of their time into your book, and they've put some effort from their lives into your book. So they have a vested interest in telling their friends about your book, having a positive review of your book, and so on. So I think it's a very good marketing technique, too. It sort of goes along the lines of Kevin Kelly's, you know, if you have 1,000 true fans, you can make a living. And that's your way between the blog post and, you know, getting these beta readers. That's your way of building your 1,000 true fans for a product.
Right. And I think there could actually be a business in this. And I was talking to Niels Parker, who was your editor, and he's a friend of ours, about a business where authors come to this company and they say, hey, I need somebody to edit my book. And the company puts them in touch with their 1,000 true fans, but, you know, a small pool of them, so say 50 people. And in exchange for those people giving their feedback on the book and making it better, at the end of it, they throw a party or some unique experience where they get to interact with the author on a personal basis that's priceless.
This is a great. So this is the second business idea to come out of this call. And I want to add, this is an industry that is exploding. We're only in inning one of the self-publishing industry. These businesses, somebody will do them and they will work. Like, and you know, I think about the marketing for the 4-Hour Body, which I guess you were involved with. Tim did, the whole idea of a party and involving the reader in interacting with Tim and interacting with the book was very powerful, actually.
Yeah, completely.
What would you say, and this is slightly shifting topics, but what would you say is the number one or two things you learned from working with Tim Ferriss during his, you know, he's a very hard worker. Despite the 4-hour work week, I know the guy works many hours a week.
You know, the biggest takeaway I had, which has trickled into my work, is just how much Tim cares about putting out an amazing product. His standards are crazy compared to the average person. Like, they're so high.
But what's an example of, like, what the average person might do versus what Tim does?
Okay, so let's see. Editing the 4-Hour Body, we did over a dozen times. That's a 700-page book, line by line. We would catch over 100 edits. He would just rewrite over and over and over. And another thing he does, so this is a better example, I guess, is his blog. His blog is hugely successful, and he has this really rabid audience because his standards for everything that he does on there are exceptionally high compared to a decent blog or even a really good blog. His guest posts, he's received guest posts from super prolific, high-profile names and turned them down immediately because he just says, you know, my reader isn't going to care about this. It's too self-promotional. Or he'll remove, like, anything affiliate-related, like an email landing page or something, because he doesn't want his readers to feel like they're being scammed. He really respects the reader and wants to deliver an amazing experience, and he really cares about that. And so that trickled into my book because I wanted to give people like the do it now and the resources and everything to make it as painless as possible for the reader.
That's great. So it sounds like by forsaking, let's say, short-term gain. So in the case of the editing, he probably didn't have to edit as much, but there would have been errors that would have slipped through the cracks. Or with the blog, you know, by making sure it's totally the highest standards possible, you know, and avoiding any kind of small amounts of money from affiliate fees or whatever, he has the longest term benefit, which is to consistently, you know, be known for being branded with high quality content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
what about Ramit Sethi, who I know you did some of the marketing for his book, I believe, as well. And
yeah,
he had a New York Times bestseller.
Right. Ramit and I worked together we started working together, I think, in 2008, 2009. And
And just to be clear, his book is called I Will Teach You to Be Rich. It's also a great book. Eventually, we're going to have Ramit on the podcast. I'm a big fan of Ramit's as well. So and he's a very smart guy when writing about financial information.
Yeah, Ramit is great. It's been a while since we worked together. I mean, the most recent lesson that we learned together, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about validating an idea. Ramit and I made an iPhone app together called Negotiate It, which just, you know how when you call a credit card company or a cable company and they have a script to basically keep you as a customer and to prevent you from, canceling. We give you the counter script to get money back from them and to save money. So it was this. We came up with the app because he has all these scripts in his book and on his blog, and people kept saying they saved a lot of money with them. So we packaged them up into an app that people could use while they're calling. The problem was is the packaging was wrong. No one searches for negotiate in the App Store. No one searches for negotiate, period. So there's no demand for that topic. If we said save money through your phone or something, I don't know, if we branded it right and packaged it correctly, it might have done better. It made its money back, but it just wasn't a big success. So that's the first lesson that comes to mind with him, because I learned that semi-recently and really took it to heart, because it was such a big project, it was a difficult project for me. And I wouldn't have wasted so much time if I'd known it wasn't going to do as well.
So this was during the period when you were kind of like going all out, workaholic, stress, doing all these different activities.
Yeah, we started doing that app a while back, but finished it while I was kind of just frantically figuring out what I was going to do next. And during the workaholic stage.
Once again, Charlie Hone, I highly recommend everybody buy your book, Play It Away, A Workaholic's Cure for Anxiety. In fact, I'm going to incorporate more of your ideas of physical play in my methods of relaxing. And thanks for all the lessons and the business ideas you shared with the listeners. This is great.
Yeah, my pleasure, James. Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, James.
Well, James, that was an excellent interview. Man, I learned a lot. What was your biggest takeaway?
My biggest takeaway, and sometimes the small takeaways are the ones that have the most impact in your life. So my biggest takeaway, Aaron, is that the next time you and I get together for a meeting, I want to bring my baseball mitt and play catch with you. Like, let's actually take that advice. Instead of meeting across a table and pulling out our notepads, let's play catch or do something fun. Like, that's how we can have our most productive meetings. And I'm going to really put this into practice.
Well, look no further than, really the first time that we met, and, it was with Porter, myself, you and Claudia, and we went to Spin in New York. It's Susan Sarandon's ping pong kind of like bar / just ping pong tables everywhere. And we had the time of our life. And you're right. It's so easy to get away from that and be so serious, because life isn't easy. Life is serious, especially as you become an adult. You have bills, you have responsibilities, you have people relying on you. It is good to go out and feel like a kid again. That's actually great advice.
Yeah, and finding, look, finding the opportunity. Like when we were kids, we used to have a rock, and I would try to kick the rock past you. You would try to kick the rock past me, and we would fall around and get dirty, and that would be fun. Then we wouldn't worry about the days ahead or you know, feeding mouths or all the stresses of life. We would just have fun, and I think kind of trying to recapture that in our lives a little bit each day is so incredibly important. Like, I can't stress it enough. You know, there's that saying, you only live once, which is a little bit trite, but look, if I can play every day of my life, then that's a life well lived.
Yeah, I totally agree. All right, James, let's jump into the Ask Altucher segment. And also, you have some exciting news for our listeners. Why don't you go ahead and tell them about the segment?
Well, okay, so we're going to do Ask Altucher for this podcast, for this particular one, but then we're going to splinter it off into its own daily podcast where anybody can ask me anything, and I will pick, you know, one or two questions a day and answer them on this podcast. And I think what's really important to realize is that the questions are not coming from, you know, the most successful people. The questions are coming from people who are right in the middle of a life situation. And those are the problems that need solving right now. And that's, you know, really been the purpose of this podcast, is to help people transform and reinvent their lives. But I've been primarily talking to people who are already on the other side of that reinvention. Now, everybody I've spoken to has reinvented their life from one career to another, and they've talked about being hitting bottom, being in the valley, and coming back up. But, you know, in these questions, I want to hear from people who are still in the valley, still hitting bottom, and we're gonna help them work their way through. Because, look, we're all, to some extent, always working our way through every day of our lives.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So on that note, this one, this piece comes from Frank, and Frank writes, I'm just going to kind of take a section out of it. I often read your posts and wonder, would James be writing such personal tell-alls if he was financially strapped? Would you let it all hang out if you were still trying to make it financially, and exposing your innermost thoughts would potentially damage your professional viability? Or can you write now only because you're wealthy enough to not care what anyone thinks? And you replied back to him, and I thought it was interesting because you said, look, I was writing for 2 years when I was broke. And there was one thing that you did to separate yourself, and that was writing with absolute honesty. Talk about that for a second.
Sure. So obviously, I've talked about before, in the 90s, I made a lot of money, and then I was so stupid. Not stupid. I mean, maybe it happens to a lot of people, but I lost everything, like every dime. I was totally broke. Then I made money again, and then lost everything. And then I made money again and lost everything. I became phenomenally good at both making money and losing all of it. And the last time I lost all of it, I lost my family, I lost my house, I lost so much, and I was depressed. And I've talked about this in other podcasts. I encourage people to go back and listen to some of them. I talk about it in my book, Choose Yourself. So I won't get into all of that. But when I started writing my blog, like a really kind of tell-all sort of blog, I was so sick and tired of everything. And I had kind of also was at that time hitting bottom. And this was just a few years ago. And I was once again hitting bottom, and I was thinking, oh my God, how come this is happening again? And I did lose all my opportunities, and I did lose business contacts, and I did lose more friends, and whatever family I had left stopped talking to me because I was being so honest. Not in a cruel way. I would never write about anybody else in a mean or hurtful way. It's just that they were literally embarrassed to be known as related to me. And so, but what happened was very interesting, is that I became a trusted source. Like, people knew that I was always going to be incredibly honest, because that's how I was writing. And this is at a point when I had nothing going on. But what happened was people started calling me and saying, hey, we have this company, can we have your advice on this? Or we have this company and this opportunity, can you introduce us to so-and-so? And I was starting to get more and more opportunities contact me because they knew I was the one person they could trust, because I was blogging about, you know, everything that was happening in my life. And so I started creating more and more opportunities, and these opportunities always generate into abundance if treated, you know, with love and care. So I started creating more abundance than ever before, than all of these other businesses combined that I had ever started before. And I started following my own advice of the daily practice that I talk about in other podcasts and in my book. And really, every 6 months since then, my life has completely changed, and for the better. And more abundance has been created than ever. And I still have these opportunities. Now, some people will never talk to me again. Some people think I'm completely crazy. Like one CEO of a company contacted me and said, oh, I heard you had a nervous breakdown or a heart attack. And I'm like, no, I just started being real with myself. And everyone else thought I had a nervous breakdown. But look, we only live once, and this is the way I choose to live my life.
All right, great, James. Well, I really look forward to these daily Ask Altucher segments. I want to encourage all the listeners out there to send in their questions to james@stansberryradio.com. That's james@stansberryradio.com. And we're going to start tackling these starting next week. Well, James, I hope you have a fantastic weekend. Any parting thoughts for the listeners?
Well, I have to say, I'm really excited to do this daily podcast. And I'm not just saying this from a marketing point of view. Like, you know, I like these podcasts that are sort of an hour, hour and a half, where I interview incredibly fascinating people. It's like the best experience, where I get to talk to my friends and have people listen and so on. But it's going to be really fun to do a daily podcast where I tackle these individual questions and help people who are in the thick of it. Just like I feel I'm in the thick of it. I'm always in the thick of it. Because if I'm not in the thick of it, it means I'm losing something in my life. And I always like to put myself into the middle of crazy and insane situations. So I'm happy to share my experiences while people are sharing theirs with me.
All right, James, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Stansberry Radio is a purely public broadcast and is not intended to be personalized financial advice for any individual's specific situation. Each individual's financial situation is unique, and Stansberry Radio should not be relied upon and or considered as personalized advice. Stansberry Radio is not licensed to render personalized advice and should be considered simply the public opinions of Stansberry Radio and its guests. Recommendations on specific financial securities are not intended to address any listener's particular financial situation.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.